The Michigan Public Radio Network, Shana Roth, is reporting today that leadership in the Michigan House has tabled most of the municipal health care bills that it had been considering and that were generating a lot of discussion. The House will proceed with one of those measures involving transparency and municipal reporting requirements. In an announcement, House Republican leaders said the other bills, quote, need more work and will be left to the next legislature in the new year, unquote. And if you spent any time in downtown Lansing early this morning, you may have seen Michigan police and fire personnel protesting the cuts to retiree health care that were a part of those bills that have now been tabled for 2017. Current state here on WKAR. Welcome back. I'm Mark Bayshore. Lansing's Capital Region International Airport got a new chief executive officer on Monday. Wayne Seeloff comes to Lansing after spending 4 years as vice president for the Wayne County Airport Authority, which runs both Detroit Metropolitan Airport and Willow Run Airport. He's also served in elected office, including president of the Board of Education in Trenton, Michigan, and is the mayor of Trenton. Current state Scott Paul went to Capital Region International Airport yesterday to meet the man now in charge of attracting business and travelers to the airport. He says the airport's location is its number one strength.
If you look at our location in mid-Michigan and the number of businesses and residents and people we can serve and do serve as an airport, that is a great strength. Another thing, though, that shouldn't be forgotten is how easy it is to travel through Lansing. You can get very quickly through the process, through the security process and other processes, and immediately on an aircraft and to your final destination. I think that those are two great things that we can continue to leverage have more people travel through the airport. There's something else, too, that's really important. We have a great, dedicated, and talented staff. Not only the staff of the Airport Authority, but those that are our partners here at the airport. The airlines, the tenants, the corporate partners that we have here, the Transportation Security Administration, Custom and Border Protection, all working together to make the travel experience the best that it can be. And I think that we need to continue to promote that and encourage those from this region to utilize our airport.
What are the biggest challenges you need to address?
Well, I think certainly the number of destinations that we have. While we have, in essence, four air carriers that are providing nonstop, destinations, both seasonal and throughout the year, to Minneapolis and Chicago, and Detroit, and Washington, D.C., we're always looking at ways to expand that. But it's important for me, at least in my early days here as CEO, to connect with as many stakeholders, residents, and businesses, and really listen to them and understand better how we can grow the airport, grow air service, better serve them within this region so that we can continue to grow the airport and, again, provide the best passenger experience possible.
We're talking with the new CEO of Capital Region International Airport, Wayne Seeloff. When an airline is considering coming into a community the size of Lansing, what are they looking for? And what can you, as the CEO of this airport, do to make Lansing more attractive to airlines?
We as an airport certainly have an asset as far as our runways and our terminals and things like this. But the airlines have a couple primary assets. It's the aircraft, often millions and millions of dollars of investment, and their crew. And they look at strategically placing those assets to deliver the biggest bang for the buck for them. Being able to make it a profitable venture and a profitable route in operation. So the more support we can show for particular destinations, for a particular airline and their specific service, the more successful we're going to be at attracting them to come to and grow at Lansing. So again, that goes back to building that great communication with the stakeholders in the region, the residents, the businesses, to really identify those those best opportunities that we can pursue to better serve them as stakeholders within the region.
How do you do that? Do you take surveys of the local population to see where they want to go, what they're willing to pay for airfare to those communities? How do you gather the information that the airlines might want?
Yeah, certainly one-on-one is in surveying is one way to do it. Looking at their existing methods of travel, you know, based on zip codes and things like that, does provide insight to us. But really, it comes down to interacting and being as close as we can and communicate the best that we can with those in the region. We can look at historical data, which provides us a really good sense of what the needs and desires are of the region. But it's always a changing game. And when a corporation or a business might be starting something new, we don't want to wait until they've already chose other ways to provide their methods of travel. So being able to uncover those things early on, be as proactive as we can so that we can address not only their needs for today, but their needs 3 months from today, or a year from today, or even two or three years from today. Again, those communications and being as proactive as we can, I think, are going to be key.
Airfares out of Lansing have been a chronic issue here. People can drive to Flint in about an hour. They can drive to Grand Rapids in about an hour. They can drive to Metro in roughly an hour and a half. Mm-hmm. And it's worth it to a lot of people because of the savings involved in the airfare. As CEO, is there anything you can do with the airlines to try to make airfares more competitive here?
Well, I think it's very difficult for airports to do that. We don't have control of the airlines. What we can do is communicate and be that liaison between the community and the airlines. Illustrate to them the power that we have, the purchasing power that our residents and stakeholders and businesses have, and being able to meet their needs through expanding air service. That's one of the best ways. There's something else that I think I'd like to stress, and that's. And that's really, while you can look at the actual cost of it, of airfare, and maybe in some cases it's a few more dollars from Lansing, but in some cases it's not. It's actually less expensive. But if you look at you really need to look at the overall cost of travel, which includes parking, the amount of time it takes to travel. And as one person that travels frequently, the last thing I really want to do after I get off of a flight from being at a remote destination is to take a road trip and in essence have a second travel experience on the road. So I think if you can consider everything that's involved as far as cost and convenience within taking a trip, whether it be business or leisure, I think in almost all the cases you'll find Lansing being top and the best value. So the more we can communicate that and the more we can make that value even better than what it is today, then the better off we are going to be as an airport and the better off the region's going to be and the people within this region are going to be.
Can your marketing campaign be part of that effort, the Fly Lansing campaign? A lot of the approach of that almost seems patriotic, like it's patriotic to fly from Lansing. It's the thing to do if only because you love Lansing. Right. Is there more that the airport could do in terms of marketing to attract travelers?
Yeah, and that's one thing that I'll look at. Again, we've got a great team here, and they're going to bring me up to speed very quickly on the things that they're working on currently and the things that they've tried in the past. But I think you're right. I mean, while there should be an allegiance to your home airport, we can't take that for granted. We have to continue to work very, very hard to provide, again, the best value for the people in this region. Continue to encourage them to utilize this airport. But again, going back to one of my other thoughts, being able to connect directly with them and find out and uncover those items that are that have a lot of potential that maybe we haven't leveraged yet. Whether they be destinations or whether they be passenger conveniences or experiences that they'd like to see at Lansing that aren't being delivered today, or those things that are being delivered today that we can improve upon. we are here to service this region.
With the word international in the name, has the airport done enough to leverage its possibilities regarding international travel or other uses for the customs facilities here?
We can always work on that and leverage that more than what we are today. But I think we are off to a great start, and we just need to continue to build upon those things.
One final question. What's your early assessment of the physical plant here?
I think it's very well maintained, and the amount of really the efficiency that is being that occurs here on a daily basis, being able to welcome people into this region through our airport and service those in this region to quickly get to their final destination is quite remarkable when you consider a number of resources that this airport has. Our airfield capacity is pretty good given all the factors that confront us and the capabilities that we have. And even though our terminal is not a new terminal, it's very clean, very easy to move through, and I think that is something that we can continue to leverage to the success of this region.
Wayne Seeloff is the new CEO at Capital Region International Airport. Thank you and good luck.
Thank you very much.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
Coming up on Current State, University of Michigan researchers say the number of lead water lines that need replacement in Flint may be several times higher than originally projected. We'll get the thoughts of the East Lansing resident charged with coordinating the pipe replacement effort, General Michael McDaniel. That's later this hour on Current State. Well, a troupe of New York-based musicians will be in East Lansing later this week, playing some of the most renowned classical music ever. They're the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center. Thursday's concert at Wharton is nothing but music by Johann Sebastian Bach, specifically all six of his Brandenburg concertos. To learn more about how the Chamber Music Society will tackle these landmark works, Current State's Jamie Paisley spoke with violist Paul Neubauer and spoke first with Paul about why the six Brandenburgs are so frequently played out of order.
Well, we've been playing the Brandenburg concertos for, I would guess, decades at the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center. And, of course, all the world people play the Brandenburg concertos. They're some of the most popular works for small ensembles. I've played in programs with every different combination of orders of these concertos, and it was never written by Bach what order he wanted these concertos to be played, except that they're numbered 1 through 6. So I have played them exactly in that order, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. But just as often there are different combinations that can be done, and it's hard to say that there's an exact good order. Part of it is just a logistical question, because the first concerto is the largest ensemble. So usually that's the piece that will start off the program, because you can set it up right at the beginning and then everything falls in place after that. But the exact order that comes after that is up to debate, and I think at the Chamber Music Society, I think pretty much every year they try a different order, not just the fact that they're searching for the perfect order, which does not exist, but also it shows the different concertos in different ways when they're placed next to a different ordered concerto, if you know what I mean. So just that variety for the people who come and hear the Brandenburgs every year, they're going to perhaps see and hear it in a different way when one concerto, let's say the third concerto, is followed by the fifth as opposed to followed by the fourth concerto. So there's no perfect answer for this, but all I can say is that all the concertos are spectacular, so you can't go wrong with any order.
Now that is a very diplomatic answer. I like it.
Thank you. Well, you know, actually, I sort of like ending with the sixth because it's hard to say, but, you know, they're all different. They all have a different feel. So it's hard to say which is the best. So I guess you perhaps would want to end the first half or second half in a glorious way, but they all end in a glorious way. So there's your problem.
We're speaking with Paul Neubauer, violist with the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center, about their upcoming performance of Bach's Six Brandenburg Concerti at the Wharton Center in East Lansing this Thursday. Neubauer has an extensive resume and was previously principal viola with the New York Philharmonic. He still teaches at the famed Juilliard School and Manus College in New York City. In fact, for this concert in East Lansing, Neubauer will be joined by one of his former viola students, Brian Chen.
Well, I play pretty rarely with Brian Chen, but I have wonderful memories of when he was working with me in his student days. And over the years, every few years, it seems like we have an occasion to work together. So it's a lot of fun to, you know, see someone, how they've progressed over the years. And as a matter of fact, he's using a viola of mine all these years. Lent him a viola, so I always enjoy seeing my viola again. And so that will be fun, but truth be told, there are three violas, because in the third Brandenburg Concerto, we have three violas, and even though there may only be two listed, one of the violinists, Daniel Phillips, will be playing the viola part in the Brandenburg Third Concerto. So lest anyone think we're shortchanging the Bach Brandenburg Concerto No. 3 by having two violas, don't worry, we will have three violas out there.
Now, Paul, when it comes to organizing concerts with the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center, who makes those decisions about repertoire, both for the home-based concerts in Manhattan and for when you visit the road, you know, venues like the Wharton Center?
The artistic directors are David Finkel and Wu Han, and they have this very large pool of musicians that they search through the schedules of these musicians, and they find the perfect players that they think are going to represent these composers in the best way. And hopefully it all comes together and then we come to Michigan and play. But it's really up to the music directors to figure out the personnel and the programs.
Overall, one of the more fascinating things about the history of the Brandenburgs that the Chamber Music Society will play is that they sat unplayed in a drawer for nearly 150 years. Now, do you think that that helps play into part of the allure of these works by Bach?
Somehow these concertos, perhaps because of their unique configurations, have turned into this must-hear, must-see thing that I think Bach would be very surprised today that all these years later, these concertos that he just happened to write are so popular. I'm sure he'd be very pleased, but that's the way it turned out. And it's quite something that, you know, it's sort of our nutcracker, so to speak, that in New York City, we have been playing these Brandenburgs every year for so many years, and this particular year we're going all over the country doing them. So I'm thinking that maybe from now on, all of December we'll just be playing Brandenburg concertos from now on. But it wouldn't be such a bad thing. It's such glorious music. I mean, you could do a lot worse, let me tell you.
We've been speaking with violist Paul Neubauer, member of the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center, about their upcoming visit Thursday night to the Wharton Center. And they'll be performing Bach's 6 Brandenburg Concertos. Tickets are available at whartoncenter.com, and more information about the musicians can be found online at chambermusicsociety.org. Paul, it's been wonderful speaking with you.
Okay, great pleasure.
For Current State, I'm Jamie Paisley.
And coming up on Current State, back in 1967, an upstart bunch of wrestlers won MSU's only title ever in that sport. We talk about that magical season with Dale Anderson, who wrestled on the team and won an NCAA crown in his weight division. He's written a book about the season called Miracle on the Mat. That's coming up later this hour on Current State. The Lansing State Journal reports today the Beer Grotto has closed. The restaurant made the announcement Monday afternoon on its Facebook page. The Beer Grotto opened 500 East Michigan Avenue back in April of 2015, but the article notes that since then, 5 breweries have opened up in the region. So we've seen an explosion in the beer sector here in the Lansing area in particular. That includes, of course, the Lansing Brewing Company, which opened up just a short distance from the Beer Grotto. Current State here on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Every Tuesday, Current State reports on the environment. There's been a flurry of developments in the Flint water crisis in recent days. Among them, a projected increase in the number of lead service lines needing replacement. Last week, University of Michigan researchers bumped that number from 15,000 to around 29,000. If accurate, that would significantly impact the work of our next guest. Retired Brigadier General Michael McDaniel of East Lansing heads the Flint Fast Start program. He is also a professor at Cooley Law School, and he coordinates the pipe replacement effort among the city of Flint and state and federal agencies. Welcome back, sir.
Thank you, Mark. Great to be back.
Thanks for making time for us. How exactly did these researchers arrive at this drastically higher number?
Well, they had a grant from Google, and they approached us some months ago to assist us in trying to determine where we have the concentration of lead service lines, which is something that we're very interested in Flint, because under the EPA's lead and copper rule, we have to give an annual assessment of the number of lead service lines or partial lead service lines that we have. But as you know, as we've talked about before, we're working on incomplete data from the city records, and that's hampered our efforts quite a bit. So we welcomed that effort. They took an assessment of the total number of parcels within the city, which is 55,000 parcels, and then they looked at the amount of work that we had done from hydrovacking, using the method to sort of use this wet excavation of soils at certain curb boxes around the city. We tried to do around 300. We were able to do about 75% of that. Based upon that random sampling, we had a projection that about 52% of the lines that we suspect would be lead or partially lead would in fact be lead. So that gave us this number of 29,000 or 52% of the 55,000. It is a high estimate, Mark, because it's based on the total number of parcels within the city.
But so they took the results of, I see it's 159 hydrovac operations, and basically extrapolated from those 159.
Right, that's correct. A small sample to start with. So some concern there, and we expect to do more hydrovacking yet this winter.
For our listeners who aren't familiar with it, could you explain briefly what a hydrovac does? This is one of the tools in your toolkit.
Right. It's one of those machines. You've probably seen them. They're used by both water departments and sewer departments. It's a less intrusive way of putting a hole in the ground where you're injecting water down into the ground to soften it up, and at the same time using a high power vacuum to suck up the mud. So it makes a fairly clean hole, in this case at the curb box between the street and the residential property there, so we can determine exactly what sort of lines we have down there below the water valve that you'll see at the street.
How does this new, much higher number impact the pipe replacement effort?
Well, it obviously will have a great impact. It is based upon, as I said, the need under the EPA's lead and copper rule for us to determine how many lead service lines that we have, or partial lead service lines, and to replace, under the rule, 7% of those each year. The idea is that if you replace 7% a year, in 15 years, you'll have replaced all of your lead service lines. So this puts a requirement upon the city to replace, in this case, a little over 2,000 by next June that will have to be replaced. Mm. We certainly think we can make that number, but this requirement ongoing, of course, will require a lot more funds from the federal government and perhaps from the state government to be able to meet that goal.
Mayor Karen Weaver has said that this means it is, quote, even more imperative that the state and federal government step up to pay for replacing lead-tainted service lines. Are you inclined to agree?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Remember that the city of Flint has received no funds at all so far from the federal government to replace service lines. We've received $25 million from the state of Michigan, from the legislature, which has to be spent within this fiscal year that we're in right now, and we're doing that. And that will take care of a percentage of this, somewhere between 20 and 25% of the lines. We think around 5,000 lines that we can do with the funds that we've received. But obviously, there's a lot more work that needs to be done. And to do that, we need funds from the federal government.
But you would say additional funding from the federal government would be required even if that estimated number of lead lines hadn't gone up?
That's correct.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a conservative estimate, meaning we estimated high. So even under our lower number from before, we would still need money from the federal government.
General Michael McDaniel coordinates the pipe replacement effort in the city of Flint. That's the FAST START program, FAST standing for Flint Action and Sustainability Team. He's also a professor at Cooley Law School. You've told me there are some nuances to this. Could you walk us through a few of those?
Well, I think, first of all, for the listeners to understand that we estimated conservatively because we are still in a public health emergency in Flint. We did not want to miss any of the parcels that there might be there. And so we took the total number of parcels with the understanding that we may not have, because we don't have complete records, we don't want to miss anything. Secondly, on a different tact is the thought that we have to be able to coordinate this with the other efforts that the state and federal governments are undergoing here. We've got sort of the efforts that the state has. One of the really encouraging programs is they just received permission for the federal government to go in and replace lines and fixtures within homes for those Medicaid-eligible folks within the homes and to be able to coordinate that. Secondly, and somewhat contradictorily, we have the federal district judge Lawson in Detroit saying that meaning the state, has to check every filter and replace or supply directly to the home bottled water up to 4 cases per individual in each home per week, which could be a huge burden on the state and city if we need to do that for those that don't have proper filters. So we've got to integrate this within a number of different projects that are going forward and assure that they're working consistently and cohesively together.
But do you view the Medicaid piece as a potential benefit? We're talking money here that could aid Flint, correct?
Absolutely. Now, that money is $23 million roughly per year for 5 years, and that is for other cities, not just Flint, but it's for other similar cities in the state of Michigan. Because Flint has already been identified, I think Flint will be first in line, but it will be available for other cities as well. And the idea of that funds is to go into the home itself and sort of do a lead abatement survey. And absolutely, we welcome this in Flint because there is always the concern that it may not just be the lead service line that's a source of lead. And if you're doing a lead abatement survey in the home, you're looking for paint, you're looking for fixtures, you're looking for soils outside the home that may have lead, that we'll be able to determine if there are, in fact, other potential sources of lead in our residences in Flint.
Let's back up to the Judge Lawson's ruling, though. Is there any advantage, is there any leverage, I beg your pardon, any leverage in Judge Lawson's ruling, or does that just make your job harder?
Well, it does both, Mark. That's a good point. The advantage, I think, is, or the leverage, is that it requires us, as I said, to assure that these different actions from the nonprofits, Flint Cares, from the state, and from the city are all working together. So by requiring that we have to go out to each home and determine the filters, we're creating an infrastructure of volunteers that can be used for a number of different projects, not just for the filters, can be used for the program that we were just talking about with Medicare, with the city having to go out and assure that we have permission from each home to actually replace their line. So we're creating this infrastructure. The concern, of course, is that our discussion and our focus is then on replacing or is using bottled water instead of replacing service lines. Bottled water long-term is certainly not a solution. Replacing service lines and assuring that we've got the corrosion control within the pipes that remain is a solution long-term.
And then backing up again a bit, just to clarify, there is a chance as well that the 159 HydroVac inspections, that was just an unusually high number of lead lines, and that the actual citywide number could be lower than 29,000.
That's true. Okay. We're going to verify that by doing further hydrovacking yet this year.
The 29,000 number also assumes that every property with a lead line leading to it is an active account, and that may not always be the case?
That's definitely not the case. We have approximately 30,000 active water accounts in the city of Flint. So, but we wanted to be able to say for planning purposes, we're looking at every parcel within the city, and then we're working our way down, wicking our way down from every parcel to every residential parcel, and then focusing our priorities on those residential parcels that have senior citizens and children under six and have high lead in the water results in that neighborhood.
And not all 29,000 lines would need total replacement. Is that
That's
right?
Also a very good point. In fact, the majority of these lines will only be a partial replacement. That means that from the water main to the tree lawn, you know, to the curb box in the tree lawn, that is a lead line. But the residents in many cases have already replaced the line from the tree lawn into their water to their water meter themselves with a copper line. So there is still a lot of lead out there, and a lot of times the replacement line or the original line is galvanized, and that has to be replaced as well. But it is less than all lead lines.
I'd like to ask you more generally how the pipe replacement effort is going, maybe from 5 miles up as opposed to just 100 feet off the ground. I know the city is hoping to cross it's the 1,000 mark, I think, by the end of this month.
That's correct.
Do you expect to cross that threshold? That's 3.5 weeks.
Yeah, if the weather holds up, we'll be very close. We've been doing a little over 50 lines a week with the two contractors that we have out there. So it's possible that we're going to make it, but with the weather looking the way it is, we may not make it quite to the 1,000. We may be stuck around 800 or so.
And beyond that, you mentioned a 2,000 target. That was for when again, please? 2,000 replacements
2000...
by June of next year?
Oh, yes. I'm sorry. Yeah, the EPA requires that we do 2,000 replacements. That's based upon the EPA lead and copper rule.
It says the 7%.
We have to do the 7%.
For some months now, residents have had the all clear to drink city water if they use a filter, but it's been reported that quite a few residents are still not comfortable with that. As the weeks and the months pass, do you know if more residents are drinking the water?
There is still some concern. First, let me say that if you're using a filter and you're using the approved filter, that's taking about 99% of the lead out of the water. But nobody wants to tell residents, obviously, that you have to have a filter on your water for all time. And that's why the other solutions, putting the corrosion control in the pipes and then replacing pipes where we can, is the long-term solution. So As we work towards those goals, we are also heartened by the fact that the water sampling results, which is ongoing, we had results from Virginia Tech just last week, which was below the federal action level. This is Dr. Mark Edwards at Virginia Tech, and he announced his results last Friday, which were below the federal action level, and we're seeing a trend down below the federal action level. It's possible that we'll have two quarters of monitoring in a row that are below the federal action level, which under the lead and copper rule is a good thing because it makes some requirements no longer mandatory, although the city and state will continue to do those requirements, such as the replacement of the pipes and others.
Dr. Mark Edwards has been on the program several times, as you have. He heads, of course, the Flint Water Team, which is comprised of himself and students and staff and faculty from the Virginia Tech. Help us understand the role of these U of M researchers. What role do they have in Flint?
So they're not actually doing sampling like we've seen from Wayne State and Virginia Tech. They are analyzing the data for us. So they're taking data from all the sources that we could possibly find, and we're trying to wicker down and get some specific numbers to extrapolate specific numbers as to what we really think are not just the number of lines that have to be replaced, but what's the areas or neighborhoods within the city where we've got a density of the line, so we have a better understanding of where we should focus these scarce dollars that we have, these scarce resources for replacing the service lines.
General Michael McDaniel coordinates the pipe replacement effort in the city of Flint. That's the Fast Start program. He is also a professor at Cooley Law School. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Mark.
As always. Current State reports on Michigan's environment every Tuesday. Our segments and others about the Great Lakes environment can be found at greatlakesecho.org and at wkar.org. Well, the 1960s has to be seen as the greatest era in Michigan State University sports history. The MSU hockey team won a national championship in 66. The men's soccer team won national crowns in 67 and 68. And, of course, the Spartan football team won championships in 65 and 66. Another MSU team, though, won a national title in the 1960s. Scott Pohl is here with a member of the 1967 national championship wrestling team. Who is he, Scott?
Well, Mark, his name is Dale Anderson. Dale came to MSU from West Waterloo High School in Iowa, a school that has produced more wrestling champions than anybody. You might recall the name of the great Olympic champion Dan Gable, who later coached Iowa to 15 national championships. Well, Gable was 2 years behind Dale Anderson at West Waterloo High. He tells the rags-to-riches story of the 1967 champions in a new book called A Spartan Journey, Michigan State's 1967 Miracle on the Mat. Dale Anderson talked about the sports atmosphere on campus in those days, including his time working at football games during the championship years.
When I first arrived, I was not on scholarship, so I actually worked in the press box, and I did note that in my book, and it was fun being in the press box and working up there and seeing us go undefeated those years. At least we went undefeated at home and went almost undefeated completely during those couple of years that I worked the press box. And that was it was a real fun time in that way. I only went to a couple of hockey games, but I did go to some gymnastics where we had national champions. We had national champions in swimming, individual national champions. We had individual national champions in track. We had a championship team in soccer. So we really had the best athletic program in the country in the mid-60s. I doubt there would be a lot of debate about that. They didn't have a Sears Cup back then, or a Director's Cup, that where you had some objective criteria as to who won. But I think, without any doubt, we had the best athletic program in the country, and it was very exciting to be a part of that.
Now, it's my understanding that prior to winning the national championship in 1967, the MSU wrestling program wasn't particularly good. In fact, 2 or 3 years earlier had finished dead last in the Big Ten. Do I have that right?
You do. My senior year in high school, Michigan State finished last in the Big Ten. They only had 10 schools then, and Michigan State only scored 1 point in the Big Ten tournament. And ironically, as a bit of trivia, even more trivia, our heavyweight fell on the heavyweight he was wrestling, and so the heavyweight that he was wrestling had to forfeit, had to take a medical forfeit, or we'd have had 0 points in the Big Ten tournament. So we were awful. We were just awful. And so we, it was one of the reasons I state in my book that it was a miracle, was one of the main reasons it's a miracle was that there's, I don't think there's ever been a team or a program that took last in their conference and then 3 years later won the national championship. I don't think that's ever happened, and I don't think it ever will happen except with us.
How do you explain a turnaround like that?
We had a lot of walk-ons that, for some reason, really caught the fever. I mean, I was technically a walk-on, but we had some regular walk-ons that caught the fever. But if I were to say, if you asked me what one thing was maybe the most important, was our coach, the head coach, recruited a guy who was a high school wrestler of his who became an Olympic champion, and his name was Doug Bluebaugh. Doug was a fantastic assistant coach and kind of attracted a lot of great wrestlers around him during the next couple of years. So I would kind of suggest, the head coach at the time was Grady Penninger, also a great coach. So when those two coaches got together and, you know, sort of picked up the program, the next thing you know, we were Big Ten champions in 66 and then national champions in 67. And actually, we started a seven-year streak of Big Ten championships. And Michigan State, no team at Michigan State or program has ever had seven Big Ten championships in a row.
We're talking with Dale Anderson. Dale was a national champion wrestler at Michigan State University, a member of the NCAA championship team in 1967, and he's written a book about that team called Miracle on the Mat. I want to ask you about the atmosphere at a home wrestling meet in those days. You've said the team won the Big Ten championship in 67. You get 66. You get into that 67 season. Where were the home matches held, and what was the atmosphere like at those matches?
When I attended the meets my freshman year, we couldn't wrestle our freshman year. I would just attend the meets. None of the wrestlers could even get their girlfriends to come and watch. It was, you know, you could hear a pin drop in the gym, and we wrestled in the men's intramural gym there, and it was. Almost scary. I remember my high school meets where we would fill the gym so full you couldn't get one other person in the gym to watch the meet. And then all of a sudden our sophomore year, because we were so aggressive as a team, everything changed. And people started wanting to come to the meets and watch us wrestle. And by the time right during 67, 68, we actually moved our meets to Jennison Fieldhouse, and because we just couldn't hold them in that little men's gym anymore. For me, I loved that little gym because you could get 1,500 or 2,000 in that little area, the intramural gym there, and it was fun. It was just like a great electric atmosphere, and that was a lot of people.
You're coming up on a 50th anniversary. How much are you in touch with the teammates from that team, and are you maybe going to get together next year to celebrate?
We are planning, and apparently Michigan State is planning some anniversary events next year, and I'm not sure what those celebrations are going to involve, but I did send the drafts to people on our team. I do communicate with people on our old team. The best part of the our old team is that they're all still alive. I mean, I was really surprised. The vast majority of people from my high school wrestling team have now passed on. but everybody on that team is still alive. And one of the another irony is that the person that was the most instrumental, probably, in our winning, died. That was the assistant coach, Doug Bluebaugh, and he passed a few years ago. But everybody else is still alive, and we're all going to try to get together this next year and see if we can do a celebration of our 50-year anniversary winning the national championship there.
We haven't really talked about any of the stories in your book. Do you have a favorite story that you'd like to tell?
My favorite story by far, 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 far and away, happened the year afterwards in 1968. I was a junior in 67, and then I was a senior in 68. And we had wrestled the University of Michigan every year, my freshman through my junior year, and they had beaten us every year. In fact, they had won the Big Ten most of the time up until I showed up, or we showed up. So they had beaten us in the dual meet every time. And we had drawn some pretty big crowds. Well, my senior year, Michigan starts out the year. This is the year after we won the national. Michigan starts out as the number one team in the country. And we started out, I think, as number two. So during the dual meet, we're getting a pep talk from our head coach. And what had happened every year up until this is we were ahead going into the heavyweight match, and the Michigan heavyweight, who was a national champion, pinned our heavyweight, and that's why we lost. So this year, my senior year, we had by far a better team than they did. And so the head coach is giving us a pep talk, and he says, everybody should win their match today except the heavyweight. That's the only match we should lose. Well, Grady's speech really ticked our heavyweight off, really ticked him off. So he's steaming for like 2 hours, and a whole bunch of bizarre things happened to me. By the way, this was in Jenison, and the place was packed. So a lot of excitement. Everybody's down around the mat. And a lot of weird things happened. That suddenly, when we go into the heavyweight match, we are behind by 2 points. So our heavyweight is getting ready to go out, and I go over to give him a little pep talk, and it's so obvious to me that he's in the zone, that he was just going berserk. He goes out there, takes their heavyweight down, and pins him. Now, as soon as our heavyweight went out to wrestle their heavyweight, everybody leaves. They start walking out the door because they know our heavyweight has no chance to beat this national champion, none. It was impossible. And so our heavyweight then goes out and pins him, and he has him on his back 3 or 4 times before he pins him. So the classic part happens a little bit later in a sequel. Grady says, this is the most exciting moment in my wrestling career. And it probably was my most exciting. They've named it as maybe the number one wrestling meet of all time. Well, sometime later, the guy who was the heavyweight for Michigan, this national champion, wants to buy a gun from our coach, Grady. He goes over to Grady's house, and Grady has this enormous poster right by where he's selling the gun that shows the Michigan heavyweight getting pinned. And the Michigan heavyweight says to Grady, you know I wasn't really pinned. And Grady, for effect, stops for a minute and then says, which time?
What a surprise that an MSU athlete's favorite memory has to do with a victory over Michigan.
When we won the Nationals, Michigan took second. And it's the first time in history that either an Oklahoma or an Iowa school didn't win first or second. That's the very first time ever that happened. So it's just kind of classic that Michigan and Michigan State took over the wrestling championships back then.
The MSU wrestling team won the national championship in 1967. Dale Anderson was a member of that team. He won a national championship at 137 pounds himself that season, and he's written a book about that season called Miracle on the Mat. Dale Anderson, great talking with you.
Same here. Thanks for calling.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
And that's our show for today. Tomorrow on Current State, it will have been 75 years since more than 2,400 American servicemen were killed in the Japanese surprise attack at Pearl Harbor, one of those fallen sailors grew up in mid-Michigan, and his final act of selflessness earned him our nation's highest military honor. Current State's Kevin Lavery recalls the life of a hometown hero, Francis Flaherty, U.S. Navy. Plus, the Islamic Center in East Lansing was one of several places across the country to receive a hate letter last week. They responded with a respectful letter and invitation to the letter writer to join them at the center to learn more about Islam. For Neighbors in Action, we'll speak with Dr. Abdelmajid Katranji, representing the Islamic Center, to find out what opportunities they have to learn and volunteer. That and more Tuesday on Current State. Our executive producer is Peter Worf. Katie Cook directed the show today. Thanks also to Scott Pohl, Kevin Lavery, Jamie Paisley, Brooke Allen, and to Drew Hill. We hope to see you on Wednesday. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.